Hello and welcome to Chats, a television podcast, season 5, Daisy Chats. My name is Alan, and I'm joined by my best friend from my best friend. It's Magellan.
Hey, man.
Hi. Hello, friend.
You're so great. You're awesome.
Wow. Is this the compliments game?
It's me being an employee of the best friend agency.
I'm so fascinated by that idea.
Me too. We'll talk about it.
You would tell me if you were hired for all these years to be my best friend, right?
Yeah.
That was for the listener at home. But John looked to his handler to make sure what he was allowed to say there, and then confirmed it. Mm-hmm. Nah, we're just kidding.
Thanks, Terry.
But, Terry.
Yeah, my handler, Terry.
Oh, excuse me. Okay. What's Terry's Sean last name?
Cruz.
Wait, the same?
Yeah, it's Muscle Man.
The actor?
The actor, yeah, that's right.
Anytime I get to use the actor in any sentence. God, Ready Player One has a thing called the Zemeckis Cube. Ugh, I'm done, because it makes you go back in time.
Oh, no. We were just talking about that before we started recording.
Yeah, sorry, people. Mild spoilers for the god-awful train wreck that is Ready Player One, the movie.
Yeah.
This is Daisy Chats. This is not the Ready Player One podcast.
Yeah, if you're looking for a transportive virtual reality experience that references popular culture, then, listen to us.
Altered reality, audio reality. Just kind of pretend we're you know what you can do? You're listening to us like on the subway. Just pretend that every time you turn your head, we're behind you and we keep like turning our heads.
Yeah, we're like kind of, massaging your shoulders or something.
Yeah. Oh, you're very tight shoulders. My goodness.
Kind of bony, but, in a charming way.
Oh, your bone is poking out now. Oh, you're a Tyrannosaurus. Wow.
Oh, goodness.
Oh, you're eating me. Oh. Oh, boy. I do like this. Anyways, now that we're inside the gaping maw of a Tyrannosaurus Rex, let's talk about pushing daisies, because what else is there to do?
Yeah, it makes total sense.
Right. These things track.
It's just logic. It's just deductive reasoning.
It's just a mixed race rapper talking about social justice. It's just logic.
Oh, I thought there
it's
was someone,
a, or it's
I
also...
someone I didn't know about named Deductive Reasoning. He's like the hot new thing.
He's what the kids are into. He's the guy who made the Kiki meme. We're cool. This is Daisy Chats. We talk about pushing daisies and also memes. This week, we watched The Usual 2 episodes. We watched Season 2, Episode 3, Bad Habits. We also watched Season 2, Episode 4, Frescorts. We are first going to be discussing Bad Habits, which was written by Gretchen J. Berg and Aaron Harberts. It was directed by Peter O'Fallon, and it aired October 15th, 2008. Magellan, what happened in this episode?
The facts were these. Olive makes a friend at the nunnery named Sister LaRue. Chuck hires someone to look into her family history, but Ned hesitates to support her in this venture. Sister LaRue is found dead outside of the belfry, and Olive hires Emerson to solve the murder. The resurrected nun says she was pushed out of the bell tower by someone looking for her diamonds, and Ned laments using his power in a place of God. Emerson and Olive find a hollowed-out wall with forbidden supplies in the nunnery, and it turns out Sister LaRue was smuggling contraband for her fellow nuns. Emerson and Ned find LaRue's secret tunnel out, and Chuck impersonates a nun to learn who would have a motive. And Chuck impersonates a nun to learn who would have a motive.
Oh.
I was just giving you a clean half of that phrase. The tunnel turns out to lead into the back of a German butcher's restaurant, and he ties them up for intruding. The chef, one Hansel von Getz, fell in love with LaRue when she first found the secret door. They eventually set up an agreement where he would make food for the nuns in exchange for what he thought were authentic Italian truffles, the diamond of the table. Von Getz won't rest until his love's murderer is found. Olive lets it slip to Ned that she knows a secret about Chuck, and he figures it out through a game of charades. Ned and Chuck debate her current situation and whether or not he should touch her so that she can move on. Olive suspects that it was Mother Superior who killed LaRue. The nuns surround her and Emerson while Ned offers confession to another priest. They swap seats and Ned reveals, in the eyes of God, that the reason he avoids conflict stems from his issues with his father. This tips off the priest that he has been lying the whole time about his identity and Ned is locked away. The priest drops his dirty clothes off with Olive, who then suspects it was in fact him who pushed LaRue off the bell tower. While investigating the crime scene, Chuck finds LaRue's secret truffle lab, and she mysteriously falls out of the tower. It was actually Pigby, the pig, sniffing out the truffle lab who pushed LaRue out of the tower. Turns out Sister LaRue was Dr. Frank, a scientist investigating the creation of the perfect Italian truffle. When Superior and the priest found out, they excommunicated LaRue. Unfazed, she tried to flee before getting pushed out of the tower by Pigby. Olive agrees to head home with Ned, and Ned tells Chuck about her mother. Happy to finally be at peace, Chuck fills in her family tree once and for all.
Aww.
Yeah. It's a meaty ep, my dude.
It's very meaty, but the thing is, I kind of like this meatiness. I think it mm-hmm. is to the episode's favor that it's a really busy episode.
Yeah, it's certainly capitalizing on, it feels like kind of the finale of the first three episode arc of the season, because it is capitalizing on the development that's been put into the setting of Olive at the nunnery. Mm-hmm. We like already know the tone of that place, and so it actually is very affecting for that to be a place where a murder occurs, because it's unsettling in a way that is engaging, I think. It can feel sort of hokey sometimes with the show when it contrasts bright, colorful, friendly, whatever stuff with, like, people are dead. But I don't know. I liked that it was a place that we had seen a lot before. And that we'd probably just thought, like, Olive's going to be at the nunnery for a while, and then she's going to come back, and it's not a big deal. And then suddenly it turns into a setting much in the same way as other settings in the show. And then it also was capitalizing and putting some sort of not a final ribbon on the Chuck's mom is Lily storyline, but it certainly moves it forward in a way that I didn't anticipate was going to happen this early on. So this episode actually surprised me with how important it ended up being, given that it's taking place third in the season.
Yeah, I'm consistently impressed how quickly things are happening in the show. Especially, I feel like in this season, we've set stuff up and already like knocked it down in really satisfying ways, and in ways that don't feel rushed. And I mean, you spoke earlier also about the sometimes hokey juxtaposition of like quaint and dark.
I think that's the point of the show. Like, it's okay if it's a little hokey because that's what it is.
Yeah, right. That's the bread and butter. That is the manner that this show works with. The shot where Olive is in the bell tower, or she's on the ground, and she's thinking about how cool Sister LaRue is, and we spend most of the cold open being like, wow, you know who's cool? My one friend that I met at the nunnery, Sister LaRue. Yeah. Cut to Sister LaRue just falling out of a bell tower.
It's like genuinely shocking.
Yeah, and it's not played like that dark. It's just like, oh, that was weird. Like, my friend just died. And immediately we have the father being like, well, that was a suicide. And starting to talk about like the whole suicide is a sin in Christianity thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. I mean, I've known that for a while. My family practices Christianity. And it's one of those things that not a lot of people talk about because it's not like something you think about every day, but I'm pretty sure there is textual evidence in the Bible that they consider self-harm a sin. I mean, that's pretty fucked.
Yeah.
Well,
because it's
harmful. It negates conversation about it.
Yeah. There can be no conversation about like suicidal thoughts because I mean, that's just the general problem with like sin as a framework for morality. That there are like things that you can do that are wrong and that taint you or damage you in some way. I think that in order for us to live in a society in which people do the right thing, I don't think that sin is a very useful idea.
Interesting.
Because I think it keeps people from having restorative conversations when they do something that like harms somebody else. You know what I mean?
And this is the problem that the nunnery runs into with Sister LaRue is that it's really easy for them to, instead of thinking about the what and the who and the why of how she died, mm-hmm. to say, well, she killed herself because people didn't like her. And that's, we did it. Like, they want to brush this under the rug. Like,
right. And it turns out none of them killed her. Like, they could have figured it out pretty easily if they were able to have an honest conversation about like, well, we knew this was going on and this, and she was up there and I was up there, but then I left and, you know,
Right, preventing that conversation prevents the crime from being solved, even, which ends up being interesting because I don't think this episode necessarily portrays religion as bad. In fact, I think it has a lot of positive things to say about faith.
Yeah.
Both in the fact that Ned spends a lot of the episode like feeling uncomfortable about dealing with the morality of using his power in a place of faith, because he is in a lot of ways doing a thing that Jesus did in the Bible, and they point that out, and he's like, yep, that feels weird to me. I was raised to think that was, he's the guy who does that. I shouldn't be able to do that. This is bad.
Yeah.
And like, that is the Catholic part of Christianity. That is the guilt. That is the, like, I can't ever ascend to the lengths of God. Yeah. But then you also have Olive, who is like genuinely saying at points that she has gotten a lot out of being in the nunnery and like giving up stuff,
right,
and pledging herself to this faith. And she's like, I feel like I came out of here a different person in a good way, and I have improved because of my experience here. And that's really nice to hear.
Well, I think this episode is affirming of the things about religion in the abstract that are good. A devotion to just a lot of this episode to me is about like the freeing quality of confession and truth. That if you are fully honest with yourself and with the people around you, that is a relief, and that makes life easier to live. And I think this episode confirms that, but also sheds light on the fact that there are different ways in which sometimes religion can get in the way of true self-actualization or self-acceptance or honesty. And we have to be critical of the way that our institutions are constructed to make sure that they are doing what they're supposed to do, instead of keeping people from themselves and keeping people from living a life that is a life that would make them feel good.
Right. It's the sense of completeness, and it's the sense of, believe it or not, this episode got me thinking about like the idea of white lies and the, the freeing feeling of telling the truth. Despite how uncomfortable it may feel, or that like it's way easier to just fudge the truth in our everyday life. Everyone tells 1,000 white lies and we don't even realize it because we're so used to it.
Yeah.
And sometimes I this got me thinking about like, what if I just tried, like I made the conscious effort to not fudge anything, and no matter how uncomfortable it was, like don't like fudge the numbers on anything. Don't fudge the facts. Like just be entirely honest. And like, will that feel better to me? Will that give me some sort of freedom or comfort that I don't have? Cause Olive gets that in the charade scene. Like she clearly wants to tell Ned about the stuff about, Aunt Lily.
Yeah.
She can't because of, pledging to keep the secret and all that. But basically, ostensibly just tells him by having him get it, like by playing this really fun charade scene.
Yeah.
Which is a really good one. It doesn't lean too hard into the like, this dumb guy doesn't get the joke. Like it's so obvious and he's not getting it. It does kind of when he's like, Chuck had a cousin, and you're like, oh my God, yeah, man, you're not getting
like it. He's not stupid, because it's freaking crazy the thing that's true. So of course it's gonna take a while for him to guess it. Yeah.
And truth is stranger than fiction. Like all of his guesses are just like pretty benign. Yeah. And he's like, oh my, like when he gets it, he goes like, oh my God. God. The plot of this show is bananas. how did you feel in general, by the way, about Ned in this, and I guess in the next episode, to talk broadly, like,
we'll talk about the next episode. I didn't love Ned in the second one. Mm-hmm. I really liked some of the moments we had related to Ned in this episode. First of all, I like when episodes of Pushing Daisies are constructed around Ned and Chuck having different philosophies about life. Because really what I'm realizing more and more is that this is a show that at its core is about like being in a long-term relationship and navigating the challenges that come up in a long-term relationship. Mm. And often those challenges are not incidents. Those challenges are differences in the way that you view the world and understand the world. And so between Ned and Chuck, there's a difference of opinion in like, is it worth revisiting the past for Chuck, it is, and it's affirming in some way. And there are things that she's curious about and wants to know more about. And for Ned, he's like, well, I want to just forget the past and totally close it off and not revisit it at all because there's bad stuff there and I get it and I know why it's bad. And, you know, I don't want to deal with it. So that felt really clean and concise to me, that was how this episode was structured. And then from there, you get really with Ned, there are two scenes with Ned that I absolutely adored that relate to his arc in this episode. One of them was when he's talking with the priest, and he's confessing.
And, yeah, man, that's the line, right?
And first of all, great, like just great suspense in that scene where the priest is doing his priest job, but he's also trying to figure out who is this guy? What is he doing here? I'm trying to figure him out. And so Ned opening up is great for Ned, but also reveals that, you know, he's a shifty character. But there are two lines in that scene that really struck me. The first is the priest says, "We weren't born with bad habits. Where'd you learn them from, Father? Like, you don't just do things that are wrong or hurtful to people for no reason. They come from somewhere. And that's why it matters to look at your past, that you can determine that." And then Ned's trying to deflect that, and he says, this other line I liked, "If I act like my father, it's strictly by coincidence. I wouldn't know him from Adam."
Wow.
Yeah. Like, just really, they're really digging into the psychology of Ned and why Ned is the way that he is, in a way that I didn't expect them to do.
Honestly, man, it's an interiority that we don't usually get out of our protagonists.
Yeah, that's the thing about Ned is he's pretty shifty. Like, if you're talking about white lies, very frequently he tells white lies to protect himself. That's like,
because the truth is harder.
Right. That's fundamental about his character, that he dodges things that are difficult because he doesn't want to confront them.
Yeah.
And here he's genuinely confronting something. And that results in the second scene that I thought was amazing that's just related to Ned. And then there was a Ned Chuck scene that's also awesome that we can talk about in a minute. Sure. But when at the end of the episode, when Ned is apologizing to Olive about like how their relationship had gone and how he was avoiding certain things and how he was like running away from her the way that his dad ran away from him and all this stuff. And it's just like, it was such a deep, earnest, true apology, like the kind of apology that you would get from a real friend in real life. Like it was evocative to me of difficult conversations that I've had with people that I really care about, where I have genuinely harmed them and genuinely had to look inside myself to make amends. And I truly believed in the way this episode was presented to me that Ned as a character had done that in a way that I don't truly believe that about other confessions on television most of the time.
The problem with confessions on television is they don't, like, especially with protagonists, you don't want to make, or there's this thought that you don't want to make your main character that flawed. Like, they're flawed, but they're willing to change.
Yeah.
And if, like, you're not going to have them say, "Hey, I fucked up and I need to make amends for this, or else I will not grow up out of this." Like, but in reality, yeah, that's a thing that we don't talk about enough, is you have to put yourself under a little bit sometimes. Yeah. Like, it's important to have confidence and it's important to have conviction, but at the same time, like, know when you're wrong and know when you've said bad things, and do the uncomfortable work of apologizing and admitting it explicitly.
Right. And again, we've talked about this, how Ned is a different mold of a protagonist. And I think this is really important for our society, that we have characters and role models who can show what it looks like to genuinely try to improve yourself for the sake of the people around you. I don't think that that's something that we see enough. And I think that I'd like to see more characters in fiction or in television, I guess, specifically doing what Ned is doing right here.
Yeah. Like stand up and realize, yeah, I, you know,
this I is fucked the thing up. That I was mean change. To you. Yeah. And this has to be different.
Right. Yeah. Is this also, and then maybe this is one of the scenes you're going to mention, sorry, but the episode with the Ned and Chuck conversation where they talk about what, is she alive or not?
Yeah. Yes, dude.
Frick, man. That's a lot.
So
but
heavy.
But that's exactly what I want. That's what I want out of that relationship.
Yeah.
Is have that conversation. Basically, what's the impetus for that?
They're in the chapel, and I think maybe Chuck was praying or something, and she's just kind of coming to terms with, like, she doesn't know her past and she doesn't think she's gonna know it, and
she talks about how she's never lived a life because her adult life was cut short, and now this new life is not in her hands, like that whole thing.
Right, like she's just so closely tied to Ned, and she's trying to get some freedom from that, but it maybe feels kind of hollow and all those things. And yeah, she just goes for it. I mean, it's a delicate balance to strike with this show because it usually plays things so light.
Right.
For Chuck to be like, hey, I've been resurrected, and that's fucking crazy.
Yeah.
But it worked for me because you can't go the whole show with her never acknowledging that, you know? And it also, this episode brings up for me, with it being so closely tied to religion, when they first revive Sister LaRue, she wakes up and she's like, I knew it. I knew that heaven was like totally made up. This is BS, whatever.
A literal nun, well, not really, but like a person moonlighting as a nun just undid everything about religion that we've ever been taught in like 1 minute. Just
yeah, like, I mean, the show is on some level saying like there is no life after death.
There's no life after death, yeah.
And so you have to make the most of this, but then why? Like, why do that? And so Chuck is grappling with that of like, I want to make the most of this life. I don't know if I can. So why be here? Why not just be dead when I was supposed to be dead?
Well, because then it like she is again then challenging the notion of what does it mean to be dead? Because if Sister LaRue is confident that there is no life after death, Chuck wants there to be something after, because then she doesn't have to be in this. She kind of describes it as like a weird limbo or a halfway point.
Right.
Where she is not in the time period when she lived and with the people that she loved, and right. She is not able to like experience eternity with the people who in her life who she loved that moved on.
Right.
Like her older family and all that stuff, and her like old friends.
Her dad and
that. Her dad. Exactly. She can't have that life, and she can't have her old life. So she's just in the space of like, it would be great if I either died completely or went to heaven, because one of those would mean that I get to, you know, have some closure. But where I'm at right now, I don't get to have closure. And, you know, Ned asks the question that we've been thinking about for this whole show, which is like, he goes like, do you want me to touch you? Is it that simple? Yeah. Should we just do this?
Yeah.
Do we want to call it a show here? Like, it's super good. It's very important and good that they're talking about this now, because we have a whole season to answer that question.
Right. It seems like that is going to be kind of the question that is in the back of our minds until the end of the show, is like, where does Ned and Chuck go? And again, I think that is like, you could map that onto being in a long-term relationship.
Right.
And the question is like, how far does this relationship go? And they're sort of navigating things and trying to figure things out. And maybe at the end of it, they decide, well, we really care about each other, but this situation is not good for either one of us for XYZ reason. So we might have to go our separate ways. And just in the context of this show, that means she dies. but that is the analogy anyway.
And to bring it home, speaking of romance and honest conversations, the chef, the butcher, Mr. Von Getz, I believe, his whole thing with the truffles and like his relationship being founded on the lie that she's giving him something authentic, because what she's trying to give him something authentic, because her whole experiments are like, I want to make out of nothing, or I want to synthesize real truffles. I want to go again, like basically like alchemy, you know, but with food. And he talks about how much he loves food, and the way that they bonded was she accidentally stumbled onto the bookcase that goes into his restaurant and was like, hey, buddy, I got these truffles. If you can help me get these nuns, they're contraband. And he's so passionate about her and wants her back, but that he doesn't know that, you know, none of that is real. Those aren't real truffles. Those aren't the things that you want. They're not the diamond of the table.
Yeah.
The thing that she's giving you.
Yeah.
There is, yeah, there's just a lot of talk about like honesty and like relationships being founded on either lies or half truths.
Right. Yeah.
But the episode goes on and, you know, we find out about LaRue's whole past, and then continuing the comparisons to like Scooby-Doo and stuff, the reveal being like, it was Pigby. I guess kind of takes the like emotional weight off of any main character.
Yeah.
For having to deal with it. Cause wasn't the priest's name like Father Dedonde? Is that him?
I think they made up that name.
Oh, that makes more sense. I was going to say, cause there's no way that like funny, I think they just call him the priest.
Yeah. I don't remember.
There's no way there, it would be really weird, but it would be very Pushing Daisies to have that like super honest confessional scene. And then him at the end to be like, thank you, Father Didon't.
right.
Be super strange.
No, I think that was the name that Ned made up for himself.
For himself, maybe, right. Like yeah. Yeah. He could have, there, I had multiple points when I was, because I did this new thing this time where I wrote the summary as I watched the episode and just added to it.
Yeah.
And I had to go back and be like, wait, I kept writing, and then Mother Superior was the killer. And then later I'd be like, but actually the priest was the killer. And then I'd be like, but actually it's the pig. Because the like probably the most red herrings out of any single episode, which is fine. I think there is a narrative purpose to red herrings, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think in this episode, what it's getting at is that it was nobody's fault.
Yeah.
But like in this environment where people are misleading each other and when they're not being totally truthful, it follows naturally that people want to assign blame, or that people feel guilt even when they didn't do anything wrong. Yeah. And so that is sort of ultimately, I think that's the point that the episode is making.
The villain of the episode is Christianity.
Dishonesty. Yeah. Christianity.
No, dishonesty. You're right. And like this, like self-honesty, if there's a word for dishonesty to the self, it's probably a good, like, Italian word for that.
Yeah. I don't know it, but yeah.
Do you have any stray notes?
Oh, I got a bunch, yeah. I just have to take some notes this time around. I like that we start the episode with a flashback to Olive's childhood instead of Ned's childhood.
Yeah, that was fascinating.
Mm-hmm. And then we do Emerson's childhood in the next one. That's pretty rad. Apparently a Saudi royal gave Olive her first horse. So that's just a fun piece of backstory there.
She did the classic kid thing of going, I want to go to, they're like, instead of her going to China, she just dug straight to the center and then went right. Because that's how you go to the Middle East. Mm-hmm. I'm just realizing the joke right now, actually. Uh-huh. Middle, aw. But she does it, and then, yeah, nothing happens except she hits a fossil, and then a Saudi royal comes and gives her a horse.
Right.
And that's how she learned that you can get whatever you want, and you shouldn't accept no for an answer.
I've always wondered why those mushrooms are called truffles, but also we have chocolate truffles.
Do you want me to tell you why?
Yeah, sure.
Let me just shatter your brain. It's because they look like the mushrooms. It's the same reason you call chocolate turtles, is because they look like turtles. It's true. They're called, that's why they are.
All right, cool.
Chocolate truffles are just balls of chocolate, like rich balls of chocolate with a sprinkling on top of them.
Yeah.
Truffle mushrooms are mushrooms that are often used to be as seasoning on top of like Italian food.
I see.
But they also physically look similar.
I see. I'm looking at the mushrooms now. All right.
Those dang mushies.
Yeah. All right. Well,
cool. Are you pro or anti-mushroom?
I like a good mushroom. It's sort of a contextual thing.
I feel like everybody I ask either loves or hates mushrooms.
I certainly don't hate them. I like them on a pizza. I like them in a dish. I like them in a risotto.
Oh, in a risotto.
A mushroom risotto. Some peas, maybe. Oh, man.
Cream of mushroom.
Oh, man.
Oh my God. Do you want to get soup after this?
Oh, man.
Oh, my God.
That's my Al Pacino.
Oh, okay. Do you want to hear my Al Pacino?
She had a great ass!
Damn it, you took the line! That's the only line I could do! Thank you. I guess I don't have an Al Pacino
impression. Gotcha. I liked pretending it towards the beginning when the Heredity guy or whatever left Chuck's apartment, that it's like, oh yeah, Chuck's secretly having sex with this like this like waifish bald man.
Yeah. I thought the implication there was that she's just now dating.
Yeah, but like, wait, that's not what it is. I think that's what they want you to think for a split second.
Well, that's the goof.
Yeah. I still don't really fully buy the plot contrivance of why Chuck's aunts took care of her after her dad died. Like, it still doesn't fully make sense to me that it fell on them to do it. But it's fine. I'm accepting it. But it just seems like, wouldn't it have gone to like one of his siblings or like his mom or something? Or I don't know. Just because Lily hadn't like claimed her, and so I don't know. Anyway,
it's like eternally confusing. I always try to think about that during the episodes, and I don't not think we're getting an answer.
Yeah, it's fine. Some lines that I enjoyed. Emerson, when Olive comes to Emerson, he says, "What got thee to a nunnery?" And then she's very excited. She's like, "Oh, Emerson, you really want to know?" He's like, "No, not really."
No.
I just
like that. I just like that play a lot.
Yeah. When everyone showed up to the nunnery, Olive says of Chuck, "Why isn't Pie Girl minding the pie hole?" And Emerson says, "Because she'd rather be minding his," referring to Ned. It's clever.
Wow.
Ned says, "Oh, come on, Olive. We're all alone here." Olive says, "One is never alone in the house of the Lord."
That's like a cartoonish line, but it's very good.
Yeah. A sort of cutesy moment. Chuck and Ned want to high-five each other for like snappy dialogue, and they're both like, by proxy, high-five, and they high-five Emerson, and he high-fives both of them. That was cute.
Aww.
Also, it would be fine if they touched each other over their clothes, right?
I think they don't want to... I think that's dangerous.
They're just trying to be extra safe.
Because fiber is thin, you know? You could still pass through fiber pretty easily.
Yeah, okay.
But yeah, are you trying to imagine like a sex with clothes on sort of thing?
No. It's just...
Oh, just me? Oh, that's weird.
Yeah, just sort of trying to figure out the logistics of what they're trying to avoid.
Can you imagine going into Pushing Daisies and someone's like, so here's the premise, here's this character, they're in love, it's a really beautiful show, it's inspired by a lot of like fairy tales and all the stuff, and then you're like, so how do they fuck? Like, that's your only interest, and you're like, I'm gonna watch the whole show just to get this answer.
Yeah,
and you will not.
They have sex with those like neon body suits, you know?
Ooh.
Those like bright green full body thingies.
It's the only way I know how to have sex, man.
Yeah. Ned's sideburns are really great.
It's true. It's always been true.
They're sort of like strong but modest. My favorite.
Like Ned.
Yeah, my favorite line is the people at the nunnery say of the crew, they're like, "We assumed you'd be Italian," and then the camera kind of holds on Emerson, and then Emerson's like, "We are."
So good.
I really like that.
Shy McBride's my fucking hero.
Yeah. And that's it. I mean, just a really dense episode that got through a lot and moved character relationships in a way that is really valuable. And then, of course, we didn't really talk about this explicitly, but at the end of the episode, Ned's like, "Hey, Chuck, Lily is your mom."
Yeah, it just like, says it.
All right. Yeah, Pushing Daisies. I didn't know that you would do that in episode 3. Of the season, but I'm glad you did, so we don't have to wonder when that's happening.
They're just running right every time they set up like a big mystery, and we're like, all right, I know how TV works. Here comes the whole season plot. It's always solved in like a couple episodes in the show.
Yeah,
it's pretty awesome.
Pretty great. Yeah.
I think I gave all my story notes. If I'm looking, yeah, pretty much. It's yeah. It's I like this episode a lot. I think this is. Exactly. This and the second one were just really strong. So
yeah.
I mean, let's get to it. But first, a brief musical break, and then we'll be right back to discuss Frescorts.
Welcome back to Daisy Chats. The second episode we watched this week was Season 2, Episode 4, Frescorts, written by Lisa Joy, Gretchen J. Berg, and Aaron Harberts, and directed by Peter Lauer. It aired on October 22nd, 2008. Alan, what happened in Frescorts?
Well, Magellan,
I'm glad you asked.
The facts were these. Emerson worked at a detective agency with his mom as a kid, and he's glad to see her in the present day for a visit. Ned is growing jealous that Chuck and Olive are hanging out more, going so far as to move in together. Veronica Villanueva visits Emerson's office to ask him to find the murderer of her best friend, Joe. Turns out two separate clients asked him to find Joe's killer, both claiming that he was their best friend. The resurrected Joe was embalmed with formaldehyde, but they don't learn any new information from the body. When questioning the two friends, they learned that Joe was a frescort, or friendly escort, for My Best Friend Incorporated. It is there that the gang meets Joe's boss, Buddy, who demonstrates a hug machine on Ned. The women go undercover to work at the agency while the guys sneak into Joe's apartment. His roommate, Randy, attempts to make light of the situation, but something about him seems off. The gang suspects Randy of murdering Joe, so Emerson investigates his apartment that evening. He learns that Randy was Joe's client, not his roommate. Randy tells the gang that Joe had a girlfriend at work who he'd hoped to leave his job to be with. After interrogating Joe's girlfriend and co-worker, Barb, Chuck and Olive get trapped in a locker, where they vent about their emotions and problems living with each other. Barb is later found murdered on the hugging machine with her lungs crushed, and she reveals that her boss and Randy knew each other. They find the body of one Aries Christopoulos in a mannequin in Buddy's office, who confirms that Buddy killed him as well. It turns out, Buddy, so desperately wanting a friend in high school, pretended that him and Aries were friends before getting bullied by the entire team and killing Aries in a rage. Desperate to keep his new friend Joe around in the present, he tries to pay him off. Joe wasn't having it, so Buddy murdered Joe and Barb as well for taking Joe from him. The gang apprehends Buddy after a big freaking fight and all this sort of cool stuff, and then we have a nice ending where they set up a meet and greet for the best friend's former clients. And everything eventually works out for everyone, including Ned and Chuck. As she departs, Emerson's mom recommends that he rewrite Lil Gumshoe to be a more hopeful story so that his daughter will want to come home. And then Chuck gets naked for Ned. It's the episode. End. The end. What? Okay, so much messier than the first one, right?
I guess it depends on what you mean by messy.
I feel like there were fewer plots that I loved. There were fewer plots that I was like, yeah, that's awesome. Like, there were a couple in there where I was like, what's going on here?
It felt quicker to me, I guess, is my only counter to that. It felt simpler and quicker. And maybe that means that there was less in it to, like, deeply emotionally connect to. Like, I nearly cried in the first episode, but I had a lot of fun with this one.
It's a very fun episode. My thing is, I wish Emerson's mom stayed around longer.
Yeah, I feel like they didn't make the most out of that.
Not even close. Because, you know, there was a scene that I didn't put in the summary where she is found breaking into his office. And they have this heart-to-heart where he's like, I can tell them, oh, my best friend is my mom. But when my actual mom comes home, it's kind of like, oh, well, you kind of have to be my parent. And you're also, in a way, a competitor because you're also a private investigator. And we can't have the relationship that we had as kids anymore.
Yeah.
And it's awkward enough to the point where I don't feel comfortable telling you about my daughter, who I don't know.
Yeah.
And so he does have to confront that awkwardness when she breaks in and tells him, like, the reveal that basically he's been sending manuscripts to a book publishing company, and through a comical series of events, one of the manuscripts got sent back to his mom instead of him. And so that's how she knew about Lil Gumshoe before he got it published. Yeah, before he told her.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're just going to see more of her in future episodes. And so that'll kind of assuage this a little bit. And this episode was just about, really, this episode and her presence in it was about laying the groundwork for presumably the role that she's going to play in helping Emerson find his daughter. That's my guess. Like, he's not going to be able to find her alone, but with his mom's help, he can do it.
Interesting.
That's I don't know. That seems to me like what it's going to be. Like, she's going to show up in a couple episodes and be like, hey, I found your daughter. I'm better at this than you are, and that's why I could find her.
Right.
That's my guess. I, despite the fact that we didn't see as much of her as I would have liked, I, on a personal level, appreciated them addressing this idea that Emerson and his mom, their particular relationship is them being best friends, which can be nice, but also can be challenging from the point of view of the child. Because from my personal perspective, I grew up with my mom and my stepdad, and I would spend summers at my dad's house. And so my dad, he's not married and he doesn't have any other kids. And so our relationship has always kind of been like, when I'm at his house, we play video games together, or we go bowling, or watch movies or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so on the one hand, that's pretty cool. Because your parent is like sharing with you things that they love and you're sharing the things that you love with them. But on the other hand, that has been limiting for us in terms of like, I don't know, what I feel comfortable sharing with him, and like the extent to which I go to him for advice on things, I would say is not nearly as often as I go to my mom for advice on things. So it's just it's a real kind of parent-child relationship that I'm glad the show is shedding light on. Because you realize that ultimately, and this is something I think a lot about in improv, so I do improv, and a thing that can kind of be said about doing improv is like, you want to set up the relationship between two characters, but it's not enough to say like, you're doing a scene that has a mother and a son in it, because there are a million different ways that people can be mothers and sons to each other. And one
many
of those
which
ways
are
that,
not biological.
Yeah. Well, I just mean like a biological mom and son can treat each other in millions of different ways that could look more like some other kind of relationship. And so, you know, there's a world in which this episode, Emerson's mom is like the classic TV doting mom who like squeezes her son's cheeks and like loves him and stuff. And instead they went for something that felt more real to me and more complex. And I appreciated that.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, Deborah Mooney's performance is really good. The way that they are each other in the TV, they're more each other in the television way than they are in like the real life way, where they have the same mannerisms. They both love money.
Yeah.
We get the fun scenes of him as a kid, like discovering that he loves private investigation and mm-hmm. money. Together, and the way that they're both bitter to each other when they first meet is like, are you gonna order anything? And then she's like, no, this place sucks. Anyways, hi, I love you, my child.
Yeah.
Like they're really if anything, it sheds a lot of light on Emerson and reminds us that he is a person with a past beyond the show and like a life outside of the show.
Yeah.
That doesn't just come from being a caricature, but comes from an upbringing.
And it sheds light on why it's hard for him to connect with other people, like why it was hard for him to talk to Ned about his daughter, why it's hard for him to I don't know, see himself as a father, and why it's hard for him to navigate the situation that he's in, because he just hasn't really had a relationship in his life that is the kind of classic parent-child relationship that you would expect. And so it stems from what we understand to be true about Emerson, and it feels completely natural to his character and makes sense that this is the relationship he has with his mother.
It's really, I think, important and interesting that the show so far hasn't really had traditional like nuclear family relationships that much, and I mean traditional in the strictest sense, like Emerson and his daughter live thousands of miles apart for as much as we know. Him and his mom have more of a friend relationship than they do have a mother-son relationship. Chuck doesn't know her parents that well and lives with her aunt, who she has a strained relationship with.
Yeah, Ned has a problem with his remarried. Father.
Right, exactly. So, yeah. Nobody has a dad or a mom. That's just the way they are.
The sort of, like, white picket fence, 2.5 kids kind of suburban ideal of a family.
Yeah, nobody has anything resembling that. I mean, even like the
that's a good point.
The not commented on but very present fact that Emerson's mom is white, and they're just like, yeah, so that's like not, that's, you know.
Yeah.
She is not the person that you expected. There are familiar relationships that are just different, you know? It's not weird. It's, in fact, they're normalizing it by just being like, everyone's got a weird family. Nobody just like has a mom and a dad that come and visit and they're awkward or they're really nice. Like, everyone's got complications. Do we know anything about Ola's parents? I don't think so. Well, I mean,
we saw them in the flashback. We know that she has like a mom and dad kind of thing going on.
Yeah, right. But they were rich, and that's what we know about that. Or were they?
I think so. Maybe there's some distance between them or something. That kind of thing.
I had a lot of notes and words about the A plot in this episode.
Tell me some of them.
So, cool is one of the adjectives I wrote down. I'm just kidding. There are some things in there that I felt like were a little bit dicey, but then there were at the same time things I loved and I thought were Pushing Daisies at its best. So, like,
great.
I have some issues with the character of Randy, his roommate, the Joe's roommate.
Yeah. Okay.
So this idea that, well, okay, so on a basic level, this episode is about friendship and how do we make friends, and really coming to terms with the fact that most of us had the privilege of just being in a shared space with people long enough that we decided we were friends.
Right.
And having shared interests. But like, as an adult, how the fuck do you make friends? Like, how do you talk to another person to the point where you can share anything with them? How does that ever work?
Yeah, like you and I are friends because we were locked in the same building for 5 days a week for, you know, 4 or 7 years of our lives.
Exactly. That's the only, and we had a mutual friend, and we had a couple classes together, and we both liked the same things. And that's the only reason that's the reason that, hey, that's the show. Hey, what's up?
Yeah.
But like, as like, you're an adult, I understand somebody using the best friend service. It doesn't seem that weird or like fantastical to me.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of, like, what is a version of it that does exist in our current world? Because we have the internet in a much bigger way now.
I think there are this sort of thing. Like, not in, like, a business sense. But, like, I see videos on Facebook sometimes that are, like, you can pay someone to, like, cuddle with you or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it's just something that exists in a certain form.
I had a friend in college who was looking into, as a summer job, she would be one of those people who goes and visits old men and walks around the city with them and like talks to them.
Hmm.
And everyone at the time was joking, like, it's going to be a sex thing. You're going to have to wear weird outfits. And she was like, it's not, like, it's just,
some people are just lonely or they just want to hang out with somebody.
Some people will pay you to just listen. Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
So I totally understand Randy having Joe as like, I want a roommate, and like, I will pay you to be my roommate. Like, I will basically pay for your living that's what he says, is like, your living expense is your fee, and I just want to have the experience of having a roommate and a friend. The thing is that, like, and maybe this comes from my perspective, but I do read Randy's relationship to Joe as a little bit like pseudo romantic.
Yeah, I think that is on base,
right? Because he talks of, I mean, Ned talks to him about like, sometimes you just want somebody to be around there. Sometimes you just want somebody physically close to you, and you just want to like understand and have somebody else in your space with you. And they're kind of like basically saying it. And again, part of that also comes from the read of like Brian Fuller working on the show, being a gay man. And you're like, you know, this, he's thinking about it, like it's in his head.
Sure.
But they don't come out and say it in a way that's like, oh, would it be better in this episode if we, cause this is just like, this service, the best friend service, is for friendship. They don't talk about it being for, like, the Villanueva girl is like, I'm attractive, but, like, the guy doesn't, like, have sex with me. It's not, like, a sex thing.
Yeah.
I just like having a person. Basically, what she says, and this is also kind of dicey, is, like, I wanted to talk to a guy who didn't, like, ogle me and, like, treat me weirdly.
Right.
And I basically paid to keep those boundaries.
I mean, I guess my question is, like, how different is friendship from romance? Really, at the end of the day, like, it's not that different. I think we place sort of arbitrary limits on, like, I don't know, what is a sort of anticipated typical romantic relationship, but at the end of the day, romance is really just a kind of friendship where you sort of allow yourself to share more and where there's like physicality to it. And so a longing for a particular friend is not that different from an unrequited love. So I don't think it ultimately matters if we like say that Joe considers himself queer. I don't think that that actually makes a difference because it he is like everybody is. Everybody's in love with their friends, I think, on a certain level.
Right. And what differ and again, since they don't say like, you know, we're just talking about like what is the difference between romance and friendship? It's a super blurry line. Like the whole.
And I think that it would have detracted something from the episode if the episode were to explicitly say that Joe had romantic feelings for
Randy,
because then I don't know, because then I think people would have read it as like trying to make this, and that, you know, this isn't great that we always sort of make characters representative of whatever group they're a part of. Mm-hmm. But I think people would have read into the Joe character as being representative of queer romance in general. Right. And that's obviously very limiting and not true. And so instead, I think it adds a lot of reality to the situation that he just at a basic level, the thing that he wants more than anything else is companionship. That's all anyone wants. And there is a sort of romantic or even erotic charge to it.
Yeah.
Because I just think that that exists in any meaningful relationship in your life.
Especially a cohabitating one.
Right. But I think this show does a good job of like making sexuality not a sort of sticking point, where it doesn't really matter if we put certain definitions on a given character's sexuality, because it's ultimately just about like characters relating to each other and wanting things from each other, and being kept from the things that they want or something like that. And I think bringing in a conversation about certain labels of people's sexuality and like putting that on top of this show doesn't really fit with what it's doing, because I think this show is trying to illustrate a world in which there is a more full spectrum of gender and of sexuality than exists in other programs.
Right. The idea of like cohabitating as friendship is persisting this episode, like Olive and Chuck living together makes Ned jealous, not just because he's seeing somebody who he's romantically interested in less, but also because he wants to have that physical cohabitation.
Yeah, like, because they have intimacy. They're Olive and Chuck have intimacy, and they have a physical intimacy even that Ned doesn't have with Chuck, like with their secret handshake and things like that.
Right. That's a good point. The secret handshake is like exactly what Ned can't have. That's kind of funny.
Right. And so this show is having a more complex understanding of friendship and romance and relationships and the different factors that go into them and what constitutes the way that you feel about another person. And, you know, you could also argue that there is a sort of queer charge between Olive and Chuck, even if they as characters wouldn't call it that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just a very blurry line. And I mean, my conclusion here is that I really like Ned and Randy's conversations in this episode. Mm-hmm. Like, because, and it kind of follows up with the last one, like, because Ned has opened up about how he feels like he has problems opening up to people and just problems being honest. Getting to meet somebody else who has that same issue and who feels isolated from the rest of society, like he opens up like a book to this guy.
Yeah.
And it's good to me because Randy is initially portrayed as like obviously the villain, like the dude has for. To, you know, Randy's the roommate and then killed Joe. Yeah.
Oh, Joe's the guy's dead.
Yes.
Okay.
That's why I was confused earlier. But yeah, and Randy has formaldehyde in his room, and you're just like, this guy's like a monster. This is awful.
Yeah.
And the show tells you that, but then Ned is like, this guy is my new favorite person on the show. I love this man, and I want to talk to him about everything. I want to just gush. And it reminds us that, yeah, again, like, we don't have to make villains. We don't have to other people who are different all the time. In a lot of it's sometimes we can bond with people who are different. And yeah, that's something I relate to a lot. I'm sure we all do. It's like finding something that feels personal and specific to us, and then finding that in someone else and wanting to just share everything with them.
Yeah. And ultimately what Randy helps Ned to realize is that you need to seek those things in yourself first. And so Ned has a like romantic revelation because of the relationship that he's able to develop with Randy. Like his feelings, he doesn't know where to place them. The feelings that he has for Chuck, he doesn't know what to do with them. And he's able to kind of place them into this conversation with Randy, where Randy's like, hey, you know, the thing that Joe always told me is you can't really be with somebody else until you can be with yourself. And that, yeah,
the line being no good at being with someone else unless you're good with just you.
Yeah. And that's sort of what the episode is about, really, at the end of the day.
So the thing that still feels weird to me then is the character of Buddy.
Yeah.
Being, it's very easy for them to like to be like, but that guy is actually really weird. Because that mm-hmm. guy was obsessed with friends and wanted friends just like everyone else does, but his way of doing it was weird.
I can see that. Yeah. If you aren't careful in the way that you read into this episode, you can have that sort of kind of sloppy, dismissive reading. I think more accurately, what this episode is trying to posit is that Buddy is somebody who had an unhealthy relationship to himself. And that is why it was externalized as obsession mm-hmm. with other people, because he felt like he needed attention, or he felt like he sort of looked down on himself and considered himself lesser than other people. And that ended up creating the way that he behaved.
Making a monster out of like self-loathing and turning that into obsession with others.
Yeah, self-loathing or like, yeah, a lack of self-esteem or a lack of self-respect, yeah.
So they, you know, they have all these different scenes of him killing people and seeing the football guy and pretending that they're friends, and then he gets beat up and then he stabs him in the back with the Spartan spear, and we get all that. Mm-hmm. And let us cut back into the present with Barb's dead body on the hug machine.
Yep.
Which is another one of those things that's like played for comedy, but we also get the scene of Ned on it.
Oh, tragic.
Right. Like, it's like, oh, that's so weird. Why would anyone want to use a hug? Oh, hugging is good. Like, physical contact is a thing Ned doesn't get to have. And he just gets, he goes like, the narrative says, like, he pretended for one sec that it was Chuck and it made all of his troubles go away. Like, yeah, it's that easy. Like,
yeah.
You can have a bunch of styrofoam and, like, prosthetic hands connected and make that have the intimacy of a person.
Yeah. The other, just to kind of round out, like, this episode from a bird's eye view, and then we can talk about other specifics that we liked. Mm-hmm. Tying this again into if the thesis I'm trying to develop about the show is that it's about modeling the challenges that you face when you're in a long-term relationship, mm-hmm. This is another significant challenge that long-term relationships face, is like, how do you balance being friends with people who are not in the relationship, and how do you balance how you spend your time? That is the core of the tension between Ned and Chuck in this episode. And on the one hand, you know, it's important to have relationships with people other than your partner, because you get different things from them. And it's important to have a relationship with yourself separate from your relationship with your partner.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's what I got from this anyway.
Right. And I mean, they have the conversations like Ned and Emerson talk about, like, why would you ever pay for a friend? And Emerson firmly plants himself in the people who don't like get like weirdos would pay to have a friend. And it's like kind of the episode kind of proves him wrong. And they're like, no, it's not just weirdos. It's just everyone. Like, he's struggling to bond with his mom. It's kind of like the irony falls back on him.
Yeah.
And he's saying, why would you ever pay for a friend? But at the same time, the one person who he considered his friend grew out of him. And they can't have that exact same relationship anymore, where he sits by her desk and does crime stuff.
Right.
Like, real people change. You can pay a person to just be your friend, and that works. And they can fulfill the needs of that.
Yeah, well, and so then here's this question about what is friendship that this episode is really asking. Because when Olive and Chuck go undercover and they first meet Barb, who, by the way, I love Barb.
She's Barb so cute.
Is my favorite part of the whole episode. She's a great actor.
Yeah.
anyway, so she says to them, like, hey, when you're a friend here, you're going to be called upon to, like, feel or express certain emotions even if you're not feeling them. And you have to be ready to do that and, like, act like a friend.
Right.
And so the question is, like, is a friend just somebody who gives us what we need at certain times? Is, you know, is it a legit friendship that Joe and Randy have where they were friends through this thing, but now they're like, now we can be real friends? Yeah, like, I don't know. What is a friendship is part of what this episode's asking.
Yeah. Well. Can it be one-sided? And can it be, like, yeah, where does it bridge the line into romance or, like, companionship, you know?
Yeah, because something that Ned said to Buddy at the end of the episode is, like, you're not actually selling people friendship. You're just selling people this sort of, like, hollow lie. And they realize that it's hollow and it makes them feel worse about themselves. And it doesn't make them feel better.
Right. I think, yeah, that is, you know, in a way, the show taking a stance on that whole thing. It's, yeah. I feel like I had another point about that. But, yeah, it's just, it's got a lot going on under the hood, this episode. And I like that about it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in the actual episode, it's just like we go to the office, the best friend's office, and then Barb is there and she's great. And they're going undercover and we meet Buddy and we meet Randy. Like, we just have introductions and scenes with all the characters. And then, you know, cut to Randy being obsessed with people and being a murderer as a result. And then we catch him. There you go. You did it.
Buddy being obsessed with people.
Yes, sorry.
Yeah. I feel proud of myself that when Buddy was telling his own origin story, I was like, wait a minute. I don't know if I trust this guy because the narrator's not saying it.
No one tells their own origin story on the show.
Yeah, no one's like, well, back in my day, I was this.
The facts were these.
And then it turns out I was right. He was lying. So
I wonder if that's a recurring thing that you can catch.
Maybe. I don't know. I feel proud of myself for catching it.
Yeah, I'm proud. I'm proud of you, honestly.
Thank you, bro. Thank you, man.
Thank you, man. Do you have the soup of the day? No. Do you have any? Do you have any stray notes?
Yeah, I got a few. Let's see. I thought it felt kind of off tone in the opening scene where the narrator's like talking about Emerson liking being a private investigator.
Oh, yeah.
He's like, a pursuit that Emerson found badass. <It's>
like, you're not allowed to say that word.
Yeah, that doesn't fit with you. I'm sorry. Early on, Chuck is talking about Emerson's mom, and she's like, add an eye patch, and she could be Lily. And then Ned is just like, how are you doing with that, by the way? It's like, okay, Ned, not the best way to broach that.
That
falls in the same bucket of him like, I killed your dad.
I think he's just very blunt.
He doesn't know how to start those conversations. He's not blunt, though. He's very dodgy. And then sometimes he's just like, anyway, so your mom, you just found out, is a person, you know.
How are you handling
that? Yeah.
How are you doing with that? Yeah.
Like, he knows he's supposed to ask, but he doesn't know how.
That's a social take that I've seen, though, before. Where someone's like, I know what I'm supposed to say here, but I don't know how to do it subtly. I'm just going to say
it. I have an affection for it. Like, it feels very real. It's just funny. I like the exchange that Olive and Chuck have when they're moving in together. And Chuck's like, you know, I'm a morning showerer, whatever she says. And then Olive's like, well, I'm a late night bath taker, a snorer, and a dish scrubber. Welcome home.
Yeah.
It's catchy.
Late morning person, morning bath taker or morning person and blah, blah, blah. They have like fun parallels.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked their, you wrote here talking about all their baggage, like them in that scene and talking about like, oh, I guess we're fine. Ha ha. I guess we're going to be good roommates and have no problems. And their editor is being like Ron Howard voice. Like, they were not fine.
Yeah.
And then they're in the locker and they're just like letting it all out. Like, I have problems with the way that you do this and this and that. And I don't like want you to have the bed over here and like roommate problems.
Yeah.
And I think the way that you talk to Ned is awkward. It makes me uncomfortable. Just like really saying everything.
Yeah. And it was a big moment for Ned that he, at the end of the episode, didn't let Chuck move back in. It's a huge character moment for Ned that he's finally starting to push people towards, you know what? We have to do the thing that feels a little uncomfortable because everybody needs to like live their own life and have real conversations. So like if you're having problems, you should have a real conversation about it and make it better. And then they do. And it's awesome. So I like that Ned is moving in that way. He's growing up. He's a big boy. Some line in here where Emerson, I think, asks, any idea who'd want to pickle your gherkin? It's kind of gross, but kind of funny.
Speaking of gross, dude.
Yeah?
The formaldehyde.
Oh, my God. Yuck. It's just splurting out of him. I couldn't handle it.
It's almost like I wanted the show to read. Like, they were playing it for comedy, but I was like, no, that's really gross.
So gross.
Like, they say, like, formaldehyde smells bad, and then he just basically vomits and just, like, formaldehyde falls out of him, and you're like, oh, this is the guy who made Hannibal later. Oh, God.
Yeah.
It's super yucky.
I didn't felt weird about all of the Veronica Villanueva stuff.
Yeah.
Like that her accent seemed really put upon. It didn't seem natural. Maybe it was, but it seemed like that actress was doing it.
A voice, yeah.
And then also this line was funny, but it's weird. Emerson's mom says to her, back when I had a rack and a couple of getaway sticks like yours, I had no trouble making acquaintances. I just like the phrase getaway sticks for legs. but otherwise, it's gross.
I'm using it, though.
Yeah. Let's see. Barb's dad. Da-da-da. It was cute that Barb and
Joe
would do the crossword together, and they'd like do different parts of it.
And she would only do the
downs, yeah. The down clues.
I couldn't tell if they were doing a thing there, though, because at first she has a stutter, and she's like, please don't make fun of my stutter. That's a mean thing to do that people shouldn't do. And then they make a joke. I'm sorry for looking into this, but she says, oh, you're a downy. And I was like, hey, Pushing Daisies, hey, what are you doing?
No, you're downy. Like, he called her downy. As a nickname.
And it was
I don't think they did that on purpose.
Yeah, I don't think so either, but I heard that. And I was, like, half paying attention at the time, and I'm like, fuck,
Yeah.
But no, it's not that.
Yeah. And I think that's it. I thought the ending was cute also. Not the ending. We'll talk about that in a second. But the ending where it's like this party for lonely people.
Yeah.
That was sweet. And then Ned's just in his apartment. He's eating some pizza.
Hell yeah.
It was awesome. I was like, yeah, the episode can just end there and it'll be great. And then, hey, it's Chuck. Hey, I missed you. Take off my bathrobe. And I'm nude. And then Ned does this weird Ned face as if he's never seen a naked person in his life. And he's like, hey, oh, I missed you too.
That's a whole boob.
Yeah.
What's the point? What? That's a really weird ending.
It is weird, yeah.
The 80s movie cutaway that they're clearly referencing. I can't think of a specific example, but you know, like everyone's seen that, like the person, like the woman drops the robes and then it's like, whoa.
Yeah.
They have sex afterwards in the movies. They can't do that. He's just going to be like, wow, those are cool boobs. Anyways, do you want to go place it? It's like Scrabble?
What's
the purpose of that?
I mean, the weird thing about it is like, just in general, what that scene is trying to show is like their relationship is progressing and they're more comfortable with each other and they're like, things are becoming more mature in a way. And so that makes like the physical stuff seem more justified or more, I don't know, makes it make more sense.
Then
if you start thinking about the specifics, you're like, okay, so I guess they go and they sit on Ned's couch and they like masturbate next to each other. I guess that's what they do.
They could sit across from each other and just honk away. Yeah. I mean, sorry.
Yeah. And I think I'm guessing that's what they.
Can
what
I take that did. Line again, Magellan?
Oh, yeah. Take it as many times as you need.
Maybe I'll get it to work on take three.
Yeah.
That's just, you know, the two of them just like cranking away.
No, give it another go.
How about just, you know, the two of them just kind of blue blobbing away? blue blobbing.
Uh-huh.
I don't want to go down this hole anymore.
Just both of them just splurching.
Oh no. That's my favorite Addams Family character.
Oh, God.
Yucky.
Anyway, so when you get into the logistics of what that scene could imply, it's a little weird. But if you just take it at face value, it's cute.
It's harmless. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I got.
Me too.
Neat. I miss trivia. I wish the show had better trivia, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it's all right.
C'est la vie. The trivia here is like the aunts aren't in this episode.
No.
They're credited, but not in the episode. It's like, great. That's awesome. Good for you guys.
Yeah.
Magellan, do you want to tell the kids at home what we are watching next week on Daisy Chats?
I would love to.
How do I do that? Wikipedia or Amazon?
Shut up, bro. Shut up, bro. All right.
Shut the fuck up.
I'm there. I have it open.
Wow. All right.
Yeah. So get off it. No. Oh, not my burp. Hold on.
I might burp. Shouldn't have eaten that pizza. I'm very like acidic right now.
Mm. Very acidic.
Achido. Oh my god.
Cool. Here we go. Next week we are watching two episodes of Pushing Daisies, season 2 episode 5 and episode 6. First we'll watch season 2 episode 5, Dim Sum Lose Sum.
Uh-oh.
The wife of a murdered chef, Bao Di, hires Emerson to investigate the death of her husband. So Ned, Emerson, Chuck, and Olive all go undercover at the Chinese restaurant where the murder took place. Meanwhile, Ned encounters a mysterious man who claims to have ties to his past, and Emerson is reunited with polygamist widow Simone Hunden, played by Christine Adams.
Oh boy. Oh
the
boy.
Second episode, yep, the second episode we'll watch next week is season two, six, or sorry. The wow. second episode we'll watch next week is season 2, episode 6, It's Magic. Famed magician The Great Herman, played by Fred Willard, hires Emerson Codd to come to the Conjurer's Castle to track down the killer of his animal assistants. Meanwhile, Ned makes a discovery of his own at the castle involving his newly found half-brothers. Whoops. All right. A little spoiler, but that's okay.
Remember like season 1, or season 2, episode 1, where it was like, also Ned's dad is here anyways, moving on?
Yeah.
Are we ever going to get back to that?
I guess that's what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Love Fred Willard. I don't want to Google anything about Fred Willard because he's in exactly that age where if I Google him, I'm going to find out that he's like a Trump supporter.
Fred Willard.
No.
Politics.
No, this is a cursed search, Magellan. You can't like what you're going to find. He's an improv comedian. There are no good improv comedians. I'm sorry.
It's okay. Okay.
The roast of Magellan.
Oh, he was arrested in an adult film theater, I guess.
Oh, he pulled a. Speaking of Pushing Daisies, he pulled a. What's Pee Wee Herman's name? I always forget. Pee Wee Herman?
I don't. Paul Rubens?
Paul Rubens also got arrested in an adult theater.
For what? For
masturbating in an adult movie theater.
Oh.
Which the joke is always like, what else do you do? Just like sit. Stupid. The 90s.
Yuck.
Uh-huh. Thank you, Magellan. Thank you for the Fred Willard update.
Yep.
With that, it's time to take it to the plug zone. It's the sound of plugging something in. Imagine if every time you plug something in, you got a cool sound effect.
That'd be awesome.
Be sick. Also, if you want to find Dana Davis, the actress who plays Barb on another show, she played Chastity Church on 10 Things I Hate About You. The like short-lived ABC family drama.
Okay.
Along with Lindsay Shaw, who was one of the main characters, who was also the romance on Ned's Declassified School Survival Guide. That's for all the post-millennials out there. Anyways, you can, if you are a fan of the show and would like to contact us, hit us up on Twitter at chatspod. That's chatzpod. You can also email us at chatspod@gmail.com, spelled the same way. If you send us stuff there, we'll read it in the middle of the episode. It's going to be sick. And speaking of sick as hell, if you like the show a lot and you already reviewed us on iTunes and all that stuff, you should consider backing the Chats Patreon, which is found at patreon.com/chatspod. Over there, if you back us at $2 a month or more, you will get access to a monthly film commentary recorded by Magellan and I.
Yes.
Where you can put us in your ears and listen to a movie. Watch a movie and listen to us. Don't listen to a movie. That'd be weird. It's like the, yeah. We gotta work another one of those soon, bud.
Yeah, we will.
Can we tease what the next one is?
No.
Okay. It's awesome.
We will next week. We'll tease it next week.
Okay, fantastic. Magellan, where can people find you on the online?
They can find me online on Twitter at Just a Fluke. That's JustaFluke. They can also find another show that has my voice in its episodes called Adulthood at adulthood.simplecast.fm. And yeah, that's it for now. Alan, where can people find you?
Can you do an episode of Adulthood where you don't talk?
Yes.
And it's just all of your friends and family like talking instead of you?
Easily, yes.
Do you have enough audio to do that?
No, but I could do that.
Make it happen? All right, cool.
Yeah.
Stay tuned. If you'd like a show that I work on that's about entirely me but doesn't have me on it, that's a good pitch for an episode. You can listen to my voice on two other podcasts. One is Fireside Friends. That's a monthly podcast where my friends Ryan, Katie, and I talk about pop culture, how it affects our lives, our views of the world, and we're going to be restructuring that soon. And it's like our fourth restructuring. It's like we're the perestroika of podcasts, honestly. We just constantly are restructuring. But it's going to stay a monthly show because that's the fun way to do it. You can also hear me on The Garnet Wager, which is a weekly discussion podcast where my friend Six and I watch the Korean game show The Genius and play Fantasy Genius for fabulous prizes every week. We're winding down on season two, man. That's some spicy stuff. I think our latest episode is probably our best, where we talked about the Monopoly game episode.
Oh, okay.
Honest to goodness, if you haven't watched The Genius yet, maybe listen to that podcast and then like listen to like half of it. And then once we get into like spoiler stuff, maybe like back out because very spicy. Just honestly super good. Love that show. Okay. And I guess if you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Alan Ibrahim, AllenIbrahim. But I don't use that shit right now. I'm sorry. I'm not on Twitter over the summer. It's very stressful for me. So that's what we got. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Daisy Chats. Keep on living.